hills where Vic was busy putting away the photography equipment. At the bottom of this hill you will find my somewhat agitated but highly skilled primary investigator. TJ smiled. She liked Vic. She have any cases pending?
Well, she's been hanging Christmas lights in town, but I figure we can let her go for a few days.
It's not even Thanksgiving.
It's a city council thing.
We followed the body down to where the rest of our little task force had congregated. Someone had brought a number of thermoses full of hot coffee and a few boxes of donuts. I got a cup of coffee. I don't eat donuts. I spotted Jim Ferguson, one of my deputies and head of search and rescue, across the bed of the truck and asked him if they had turned anything up on their walk around. His mouth was full of cream filled, but the gist was no. I told him I was going to replace his staff with the sheep.
We did a 300-yard perimeter, but the light wasn't so good. We'll do another as soon as everybody gets a donut and some coffee. You think this guy left brass?
I hope. I took my coffee and moved over to where TJ and Vic were seated on a tailgate. They were looking at some of the evidence. Hopefully they were discussing something I could understand.
Single shot, center. Didn't get too much of the sternum. Vic held a bag up to the rising sun and looked at the metal fragment inside.
Fuck, I don't know.
TJ patted the spot beside her with the palm of her hand, and I sat. Vic continued.
It looks like a slug. I'm thinking 12-gauge or something just a little bigger.
Bazooka?
She lowered the bag, and her eyes met mine.
You're getting rid of me?
I nodded my head.
Yep.
Why?
Because you're a big pain in the butt.
Fuck you.
And you talk dirty.
She handed the bagged bullet to TJ.
You're going to be stuck up here with Turk.
Yeah, well, maybe we'll get the Christmas lights put up together.
Vic snorted and readjusted her gun belt.
Besides, you've forgotten more about this space-age stuff than I'll ever know. You can relay information back to me.
The tarnished gold stared at me, unblinking.
You'll only be down there for 2 days. It'll take us that long to round up all the usual suspects.
I was the old dog who had learned his fill of new tricks, and it was only logical that I work the county and the people. She poked me in the belly. Her finger remained in one of my fat rolls, and she poked each word for emphasis.
If search and rescue don't find anything, you gonna call Omar?
That's another reason for you to leave. You don't like Omar.
She poked me again. You be careful, all right?
This all sounded very strange coming from Vic's mouth, but I took it as a fiction and punched her on the shoulder.
I'm always... She knocked my hand away.
I mean it.
She didn't have kind eyes. They rarely looked away, and they always told the truth. I could use eyes like that.
I've got a funny feeling about all of this.
I gazed back up to the patch of sage and scrub weed and watched the sun free itself from the red hills.
Yeah, well, you got 5 hours to talk to TJ about this woman's intuition thing.
The next poke hurt. I hung around the scene until search and rescue had finished their second sweep. I sat in the bullet and filled out the reports.
Ferg strolled up with a cup of coffee and another cream-filled. Anything?
Fortunately, I caught him between bites.
Nothing. We got a lot of sheep shit and tracks.
Any suspicious sheep tracks?
Nope. No suspicious sheep shit either. It's like the Denver stockyards up there.
I thought about how you could kill a victim only once, but how a crime scene could die 1,000 deaths. I hoped that whatever useful information could be deducted from this patch of God's little acre was traveling safely in plastic bags toward Cheyenne. Motives are all fine and good, but if we could find out the how, we'd have a shooting's match chance of finding out the who. I had the niggling feeling I was going to have to call Omar.
On the drive over to the Pritchard's place, I thought about the last time I had seen Cody alive. He was a heavy-set kid, built like a linebacker, curly blonde hair and pale blue eyes. He had his mother's looks, his father's temper, and nobody's brains. I'd pulled him out on 3 occasions, the last being the rape case.
Cody had endeared himself to the local Native American community by being quoted in the Sheridan paper as saying, "Yeah, she was a retard redskin, but she was asking for it." The Pritchards had a place on the outskirts of Durant, and by the time I got there, there must have been 8 or 9 cars and trucks in the drive. Word carries fast in open spaces. As I cut off the engine, the full impact of what I was going to have to do hit me like a Burlington Northern. How do you tell parents that their child is dead? Sure, they'd heard it through the grapevine, but I was the official word. I allowed myself a long sigh. There were field swallows swooping near the bullet. I was probably disturbing their family, too. Seemed to be my day for it. It had been longer than 24 hours since sleep. It's easy to work all night because the sun doesn't come up, but when it does, my eyes start to sting and the rest of me gets a little shaky. I've always been this way. I was focusing my eyes when I heard the screen door slam and saw John Pritchard walking down the drive. I never cared too much for John. He was one of those guys who always had to be in control. The conversation wasn't as bad as it could have been. The pertinent information from him was that Cody had left the house 27 hours ago with an extra dough license. The pertinent information from me was that he wasn't coming home. I did the best I could, drove the 7 miles back to my place, and sat on the porch, well, the front doorway, but not for very long because it was cold. I had the presence of mind to fall into the house instead of out of it. I drifted in and out of consciousness until the phone rang, and the answering machine my daughter made me buy picked up. "You've reached the Longmire residence. No one is available to answer your call right now, 'cause we're out chasing bad guys or trying on white hats. If you leave a message after the tone, we'll get back to you as quickly as we can. Happy trails." She had taken a great deal of joy in recording the message printed in the instructions with a few minor alterations. I smiled every time I heard it. "It's pancake day," the voice resonated through the lines from 14 miles away. Jim Ferguson was not only head of search and rescue and my longest-standing part-time deputy, but he was also the man in charge of driving around Durant once a year at dawn in the fire department's truck, proclaiming through a bullhorn, "It's pancake day, pancake day." There are only 3 major vote-getting days in Absaroka County, and I can't remember the other 2. Oh, God, no, it's pancake day. I thought about shooting myself. I could see the headline, "Sheriff Shoots Self Unable to Face Pancakes." "It's pancake day." Ferg really enjoyed his work. "I've been trying to get a hold of you for the last hour. Just thought somebody ought to call and remind you, but if you really are going to retire next year, then who gives a shit?" I stumbled to the phone beside the recliner. "Is it really today?" "If I'm lying, I'm dying." There was a pause. "Hey, Walt, if you want, I can just tell him we were up all night." Ferg was slightly in the Turk camp for future sheriff, but I had other plans. If Vic was going to be the first female sheriff in Wyoming, I only had a year to pull in all my political markers. I could last an hour of pancake day with the Elks, the Eagles, the Lions, the J.C.'s, the Daughters of the American Revolution, and, of course, the AARP's. "I'll be there in a half hour."
"Remember, it's at the Catholic Church this year."
"You bet." I plugged in the coffee maker and dumped enough coffee for 8 cups into the filter with only enough water for 4. I took a shower while it was perking. The plumbing was somewhat makeshift, but the water that came from above went away below. It went away below through a bathtub that Henry had found for me for $20. Somebody on the res had used it for target practice with a .22, but had only chipped the porcelain. Then there was a shower curtain. I don't know what the exact physical dynamics are that cause a shower curtain to attach itself to your body when you turn on the water, but since my shower was surrounded on all sides by curtains, I turned on the water and became a vinyl, vacuum-sealed sheriff burrito. I slid behind the wheel of the bullet and started driving the 14 miles to town. Durant is situated along the Bighorn Mountains, and because there is abundant fish and game, it's become the retiree capital of Wyoming. In Absaroka County, to ignore the octogenarian vote is to pump gas at the Sinclair Station for a living. Service jobs are about all there are in Durant, somewhat stunting the younger generation and forcing the majority out by age 19. But the retirees keep coming from Minnesota, Wisconsin, Illinois, and Iowa, with the odd Texan and Californian thrown in for spice. They come looking for the romance of the West that they had paid shiny quarters to view on Saturday afternoons in flickering black and white. They waited half a century of stamping out automobile bumpers to get their Western dream. They paid for it, and by God, they were going to have it. Most ended up picking up and moving out, headed for Florida, Arizona, or wherever the weather was easier. I liked the ones who stayed. You'd see them out after the blizzards, shoveling away and waving at the bullet like it was the circus come to town. Hell, I'd stop and talk to them. Sheriffs have to get elected in Wyoming, so we have to be liked. I imagine that if you had to elect the average police force, the turnover rate would spin your Rolodex. When I first started out, it was the part of the job that I enjoyed the least, courting the public. But as time wore on, it got to be the part that I enjoyed the most. Martha was right when she said that I needed a bumper sticker that said, "Born to Bullshit." The debates were the best part. In 81, old Sheriff Connolly planned a peaceful takeover. He ran against me so no one else could and had lofted softballs to me so that I felt like Harmon Killebrew by the time the debate was over. I was elected. Lucian retired and was now living the high life in room 32 at the Durant Home for Assisted Living. I still went over on Tuesday nights to play chess, and he still kicked my ass, to his unending delight. I looked at the inch of snow that dappled the sagebrush. It looked like a Morse code of white dots and dashes leading down the road. If I could read the message, would it tell me the story I wanted to hear? The truth still stood that I was a sheriff who had survived by the cult of personality, and that if the trend were to continue, my heir apparent wouldn't be elected. Was I just trying to force Vic down the throats of the county because I could? No, she was the best person for the job, and that was the reason I was going to have to keep pushing. Pancake day, pancake day. I idled down into second gear at the corner of Main and Bighorn and looked down the street to see Turk's Trans Am parked at the office. Just seeing his car made my ass hurt. I didn't feel like facing him on an empty stomach. I hoped he would have already contacted Lavanda Running Horse over at Game and Fish for any information we could get about last night's incident. I circled quickly around the courthouse to avoid being seen and made a beeline for the Catholic Church. The place was mobbed, and there was no parking. I wheeled the bullet onto the concrete pad beside the HVAC unit and cut the engine. I figured the Pope wasn't coming today. Well, if it isn't the long arm of the law! It was an old joke, but one I didn't mind. Longmire, pull up a chair and sit yourself down. Steve Brandt was the mayor of Durant, and the de facto president of the Business Associates Committee, a loosely affiliated group of warring tribes that made up the commercial facet of the downtown. He also owned the screen printing place on Main and had done the T-shirts for the annual Sheriff's Department versus Fire Department softball game. But the less said about this, the better. Next to him was David Fielding of the sports shop, Elaine Geary, who had the art gallery, Joe of Joe Benham's Hardware and Lumber, Dan Crawford from the IGA, and Ruby. "What are you doing here?" Ruby's chin rested on her palm, fingers trailing into the hollow below her cheekbones. I figured cheekbones were one of those things you gained from speedwalking 5 miles a day. I slipped off my coat and sat on it. "Well, I'm here to support the courageous Durant Volunteer Fire Department's men in non-flammable nylon. Do you think their hats are cooler than ours?
Shouldn't you be home in bed?"
I took my hat and perched it on her head. It looked jaunty. I turned to the others at the table.
This is the problem I have with all the women I know. They're always trying to get me into bed. There was a derisive chuckle around the table, and Ruby took my hat off, sitting it on the table, brim up. Good Wyoming girl. It's 'cause I look so much like Gary Cooper. General opinion at the table projected their cinematic consensus to more like Hoot Gibson, whereupon I changed the subject. So, how are the pancakes?
We don't know. We've been here for 20 minutes and ain't seen a damn pancake yet.
Joe Benham was in a lean and hungry mood.
Might be for the best. They aren't letting the firemen cook again, are they?
You'd think they'd learn to not trust him with fire. David's comment referred to the infamous stove oil incident, wherein the firemen had set fire to the old wood-burning stove at the Future Farmers of America Hall, resulting in that year's pancakes tasting roughly like roofing shingles.
The best was when they almost burned their truck up at that grass fire out near you.
Elaine, being a patron of the arts, always appreciated spectacle. Ruby placed a steaming styrofoam cup of coffee in front of me. I hadn't even seen her get up.
Thank you, ma'am.
I took a sip and listened to the rumble as it joined the other four cups in my stomach. I was hungry, and that was not a good thing on pancake day.
We were just discussing the city Christmas decorations, Walt. Do you think they're the ugliest in Wyoming?
Elaine had a twinkle in her eye. As part of the city council, she had been lobbying for new decorations for about 6 years now. The problem was that Joe's father had designed and executed the offending artistry of Santa, elves, reindeer, bells, wreaths, candles, trees, mistletoe, holly, stars, and toys 25 years ago. Say what you want about 3/4-inch exterior ply, it holds ugly for a long time.
Gillettes are uglier, I ventured.
We heard you had a busy night.
Dan Crawford picked up his coffee and blew into it, watching the swirls of cream separate at the riptide on the other side of his cup. It got quiet. This was going to be the prime topic of conversation for the morning, so I might as well develop an official line.
Nothing big. We had a hunting accident out near 137 on BLM land.
I tried to make it sound like the end of the story.
We heard there was a boy dead.
Dan continued to look at his coffee.
Well, what else have you heard?
It got even quieter. No offense, Dan, but I'm not going to sit here and play guessing games with you. Why don't you just tell me what you know, and I'll either confirm or deny it or not. His face reddened, which was not what I was after.
I didn't mean anything, Walt. Just curious.
He meant it. I rubbed my face with my hands and looked at all of them. I hope you'll all excuse me, but it's been a long night. I sighed. With all due respect to the ongoing investigation, it would appear that on the night past, one Cody Pritchard departed for the far country from which no traveler born returns. The illusion was not lost on Elaine.
Have you narrowed it down to a couple of 100,000 suspects, as in something rotten in the state of Denmark or Iowa?
Joe nodded.
Well, I don't figure there'll be any public outcries of mourning.
Elaine ventured that there might be a parade, then saved me by asking if I was willing to play The Ghost of Christmas Future in the Civic Theater's upcoming production of A Christmas Carol. I was pretty sure that she wanted me for my height and not my dramatic skills. This was confirmed when she assured me that I wouldn't have to learn any lines and that all I had to do was point. I excused myself to see a man about a horse and made for the boys' room at the far end of the hall. On the way, I got a peek through the kitchen service opening and was startled to see Vonnie Hayes sliding a stacked platter of pancakes to a waiting fireman. She looked much as she did last evening, which seemed like another life. Her hand came up and swiped back a stray wisp of hair that had escaped from the loose bun. It's funny how the little movements that a woman makes seem so individualized, like a signature. It was the rotation of the wrist with a 2-finger pull. I gave it a 10,
and was aroused. I waved and thought she had seen me, but maybe I was wrong. She smiled at the young fireman and disappeared into the kitchen. Those firemen, they make out like bandits. In the boys' room, I attended to business, washed my hands, hit the button on the hand dryer, and wiped my hands off on my pants to the quiet hum of modern technology. It was then that I realized I was wearing my weapon. I don't wear my gun to community functions, and I don't wear it on weekends. I was actually famous for taking it off and leaving it places. Periodically, Vic would bring it back to me from the bathroom in the office or out of the seat of the bullet. She liked to make fun of my antique armament by calling it the blunderbuss. Heavy, hard to aim, slow rate of fire, it was the weapon I had used in Vietnam for 4 years, and I'd gotten used to it. The Colt 1911 A1 had a grisly but effective past. During the Philippine campaigns, the islanders took to getting doped up and wrapping themselves in sugarcane. United States servicemen had the glorious experience of shooting these natives numerous times with no result before being hacked to death by their machetes. Obviously something with a little more hitting power than the standard issue 38 was needed. John Browning's auto-loading, single-action child graduated to .45 caliber, and the Filipinos began flying back out of the trenches they had hurled themselves into. Unaccurized, the weapon was about as precise as a regulation basketball, but if you hit something with it, chances were good the fight was over. I thumbed the standard duty holster open and took the weapon out to check it, an old habit. The matte finish was rubbed off at the sights and the ridges along the barrel's slide action. Fully loaded, which it was, it regularly weighed 38.6 ounces. But today it seemed to weigh about 3 tons. What the hell was it doing on? Was I responding to some unconscious threat? Did I know more than I thought I knew? It was about this time that I became aware of the bathroom door being opened, and a fully dressed fireman looked at me and my gun. I didn't think the pancakes were that bad.
Hello, Ray.
He was the young one I had seen talking to Vonnie at the kitchen window. You need in here? It took him a moment to respond. Miss Hayes sent me over. You got a phone call in the kitchen. It was probably the first time he had ever used the title Ms. in his life. He still didn't move.
Anything else?
He smiled, embarrassed. You going to shoot somebody? I thought for a moment and sighed.
Anybody need shooting?
Not that I know of. He looked away for a second. Sounds like the only one that needed it got it last night. He was roughly Cody Pritchard's age, and they probably had gone to school together. I nodded and started to squeeze by him.
What's the, story on Cody?
I stopped, and we were lodged in the doorway. I looked down at him.
Well,
I paused for effect.
He's dead.
I watched him to see if there was anything else. There wasn't, so I smiled. You better get some pancakes over to the mayor at the business associates committee table before you guys are putting out fires with a bucket brigade.
You bet. Always good to know on which side your pancake is buttered.
As I made my way toward the kitchen, I mused on the thought of being caught in the bathroom playing with my gun. Great. As if everybody in the county didn't already think I was loony as a waltzing pissant. When I got to the kitchen door, Vonnie already had it open.
No rest for the wicked?
I wish. God, she looked good, with that little bit of sweat in the hollow at the base of her throat.
The phone's over by the sink, back hallway.
I breezed by, trying to exude competent professionalism as I picked up the receiver from the drain board. Longmire.
Jesus, are you eating again?
The long-distance whine from Cheyenne was no surprise. In my experience, most things from Cheyenne whined. I am motivating the constituency and have yet to eat any pancakes. What are you still doing awake?
The state medical examiner just finished his preliminary.
Let me guess, lead poisoning?
Yeah, the Rig Live says it was about 6:30 when he got it. Gives some credibility to the hunting accident scenario. changing light and all. But
this must be good. But
massive cavitations with a lot of radio-opaque snowstorm.
My mind immediately summoned up a visual X-ray with the usual fragments of civilian hunting ammunition. Obviously, this was not the case. Non-military?
Maybe semi-jacketed, maybe not. It's a really strange caliber, and it's big.
What?
We don't know yet.
This was something. With Vic's specialty in ballistics back in Philadelphia, I had assumed her initial assessment that it was a 30-06 was gospel. What do you think? There was silence for a moment.
I don't think it's a deer gun.
I raised an eyebrow. Really?
I know what a fucking high-powered slug looks like, all right?
I let it set for a moment, and so did she. Why don't you get some sleep? It was fun saying it to someone else. Silence.
He had a cheeseburger with jalapeno peppers.
I'll go by the Busy Bee and talk to Dorothy. Anything else? Silence.
Go talk to Omar. He's a crazy motherfucker, but he knows his shit.
Silence.
So, do you miss me?
I laughed. When I hung up the phone, Vani was holding a plate where a steaming stack of pancakes lay waiting.
I figured this was the only way you were going to get to eat. She relaxed and leaned her back against the wall. With the apron on and her hair up, she looked like an Amish centerfold. You have a lot of women in your life.
You think that's a good thing or a bad thing? I said between bites.
She peered over her coffee cup. Her eyes were enormous. Depends on the women.
I nodded and chewed.
It's just got to be difficult. I don't know how you do it.
Well, it's not my usual routine. Running 10 miles at dawn, 300 sit-ups. She let go with this snorty laugh and apologized, holding her hand to her face.
How are your pancakes?
I took a breath. They're great, thank you.
I heard you used to make animal shapes with pancakes. She smiled mischievously.
You've been talking to one of the women in my life.
I have, it's true. I learned all kinds of little secrets about you when she was working for me.
I nodded, thought about little secrets, and took my last bite. The deal was this. If she went to church on Sunday mornings with her mother, she didn't have to eat her heathen father's breakfast. It's a wonder she didn't turn into a devout Methodist.
That's not what she told me. She said she liked having you all to herself.
And now she does. It was out before I knew I had said it. I had gotten so used to joking about Martha's death, but here it just seemed wrong. Sorry.
Do you ever get lonely, Walter?
Oh, sure.
I tried to think of something else to say, but nothing seemed honest enough. All I could think of was how soft and inviting she looked.
I had this unfocused image of her, my bed back at the ranch, and all my worldly needs being gratified at once. This didn't seem appropriate either.
Maybe we should get together sometime.
Maybe it was appropriate. Why, Ms. Hayes, are you making a pass at me? I emphasized the Ms. Her eyes sparked.
Maybe, Mr. Longmire, though I must admit your indifference and the gauntlet of women I may have to face seem daunting.
Well, they're a pretty tough bunch, so I can understand.
The term a pride comes to mind. She took a sip of coffee. Maybe we should start with lunch.
It was a short drive back to the office, where I parked behind the jukebox Turk called his car. It was some kind of Trans Am, at least that's what it said all over it. That wasn't all it said, since it looked as if every available surface was covered with some sort of sticker. It had stickers on the bumper to proclaim every ill-considered political opinion that had ever crossed Turk's apolitical mind. Advice on the ex-president, his family, gun control, pro-rodeo, state nativism, and honking if you were horny. On the back window, it had little cartoon characters peeing on each other and on the emblems of other vehicles. It seemed to me that there wasn't anyone that could look at this car and not be offended. It was a lot like Turk. When I pushed open the door, no one was in the reception area. I stood there with the doorknob in my hand and listened. There was a shuffling noise in my office, and I heard one of my file cabinets shut. A moment later, he turned through the doorway in full saunter. His eyes stayed steady as I shut the door behind me.
"Man, it's about time. I've been sitting around here for hours."
I wasn't sure if he considered being offensive to be the best defense or if it was just his natural state.
"Running Horse called. She said they had some hunters that asked about the BLM land out on the Powder River near 137, Section 23. They're still here, staying at the Log Cabin Motel. Want to go talk to them?"
I let it set for a few seconds. "What are you doing in my office?" He was a handsome kid with what the romance novels would call smoldering good looks. Dark coloring with wavy black hair and a Van Dyke goatee accenting the basque on his mother's side. Just shy of 6.5 feet, most of its shoulder, he was a handy thing to have crossing his arms and looking menacing behind me in a domestic disturbance. But other than that, I had found little use for him. I had taken him on as a favor to Lucian. He didn't like him either, but Turk was his nephew, and I felt obliged.
"I was just checking things out."
"In my office?" His face darkened a little past smoldering.
"Hey, might be my office someday."
He looked toward Vic's windowless little room across the hall from mine. There were no pictures on her walls. There were just books. Shelves and shelves of books. You had to reach through the blue binders of Wyoming Criminal Procedure on the third shelf next to the door to turn the light on and off. "Turk, I've been up for 2 days, and I'm getting a little edgy. You get my meaning?" He straightened.
"Yes, sir."
I was liking him better. "Now, there are a few things you can do to endear yourself to me in the next few days, starting with doing what I tell you to do, keeping your mouth shut as much as possible, and staying out of my office. Got it?"
"Yes, sir."
"Now, what I want you to do is run over to the Busy Bee and ask Dorothy Caldwell when she saw Cody last."
"You want me to get a statement from her?"
I lowered my head. "She's not a suspect, so don't treat her like one, or she's liable to kick your ass. Just go over and ask her when she last saw Cody Pritchard, okay?"
"Yes, sir."
"You don't have to keep calling me sir. Hell, I'll call you anything you want, long as it gets me on your good side for once." I tried not to, but the smile played on my face for an instant.
"You sure you don't want me to go with you to talk to the hunters?"
I sighed as he pulled out a small black vinyl notebook and a section map of the state.
"I went by earlier and got the plate numbers, Michigan, with no wants or warrants. Willis at the office said there were 4 of them."
He paused for a moment.
"They're going to be armed."
"Well, I'll put on an orange vest before I go over." I reached out and tore the page from his notebook and took the map. He didn't like me taking his evidence, but followed me out the door anyway. I pointed over to Vic's unit. "Take that one."
"That's all right. Mine's warmed up."
We paused beside his car. "I am proud to say that this vehicle does not accurately represent the Absaroka County Sheriff's Department." I guess it hurt his feelings.
"This car will do 160.
"I doubt that, and if it does, it better not do it in this county. Anyway, I don't think Dorothy's going to run for it, so you're safe." I nodded toward the office. "Hanging by the door with a Phillies keychain." "Whiz kids." He slumped and started back, stopping to ask,
"We meet back here?"
"Sure, we'll synchronize watches." It was 6 blocks to the Log Cabin Motel on 16, leading toward the mountains. It's an old-style place with 12-by-12 log structures and faded red neon. I pulled the Bullet up to the office and went in to talk to Willis, who informed me that the Michigan men had been up late celebrating their last night in town. This didn't sound like men who had shot somebody, but you never knew. Willis asked who whacked Cody Pritchard, and I asked him why it was that when somebody died in town, everybody started talking like John Garfield. They were in cabins 7 and 8, so I walked down the row beside the imprint of Turk's 50-series tire tracks. Top-flight detective work. I'm sure with the glass-pack mufflers he had been as inconspicuous as the Daytona 500. There was a brand-new Suburban parked between the two cabins, Michigan plates. I couldn't believe he had called them in. I knocked at the door of the nearest cabin and heard a muffled groan. I knocked again. Oh, God. I knocked again. Sheriff's Department, could you open the door, please?
Randy, this is not funny.
I leaned against the glossy green door jamb and knocked once again. After a few seconds, a young man in his underwear and a camo T-shirt snatched open the door.
Do you know what time it is?
He was short and kind of round, with light brown hair and a 2-week beard. It didn't take long for him to figure out I wasn't Randy. Good morning. I'm Sheriff Longmire, and I'd like a word with you. At first he didn't move, and I could see the wheels turning as he tried to figure out what it was that he had done to bring himself in contact with me. These few moments in the beginning can often tell me what I need to know. You hear about eye movement, nose touching, all that crap, but when you get right down to it, it's just a feeling. The little voice in the back of your head just says, "Yeah, this is the guy." My little voice had taken the fifth, and I figured this was not the guy. Besides, I was probably looking for a perpetrator who had acted alone. I told him he could put his pants on. I waited out by their SUV and watched the cars go by. The air was brisk, and I was starting to regret not bringing my coat from the Bullet. The aspen trees around the cabins and adjacent campground were a bright butter and shimmered in the light wind. They'd been tenacious in the face of the small snowstorm of the evening before, trying to hold on to fall. Only a few loose leaves tumbled across the gravel toward the alley behind the motel. But the sun was shining this morning, and the whole place just seemed to glow. He remembered his jacket. After he closed the door to the cabin, the curtain flipped back just a touch and then hung slack, as it had before. "You want the other guys, too?" I introduced my most ingratiating smile. "No, I figure you'll do." He didn't seem happy with this turn of events. "I'm afraid you have me at a disadvantage, mister."
"Anderson, Mike Anderson."
He was quick with it, and the name matched the registration of the vehicle. "Mr. Anderson, do you mind taking a little walk with me here?" I gestured toward the office where the Bullet was parked, and, more importantly, where my jacket lay on the seat. He started, and I figured this guy's never had any dealings with law enforcement in his life other than traffic violations. I figured to start easy. "Why don't you tell me about last night?" He bit his lip, nodding his head in agreement.
"I am really sorry about all that noise."
Mm-hmm was one of my secret weapons. I could give out with a non-committal with the best of them.
"We didn't tear anything up. I mean, we made a lot of noise."
"Willis did mention it. But that's not why I'm here." Now he looked really worried. "I just need to ask you about the areas that you might have hunted in your visit here." We had arrived at the Bullet, where I opened the door, fished out my coat, and pulled it on. "Sorry, it's getting a little cool. The areas, sections for your hunting permits?" His eyes stayed in the truck, taking in the radio, radar, and especially the Remington 870 that was locked to the dash. After a moment he spoke.
"You mean the numbers?"
"Yep, that would be helpful." I waited. "You're not sure what the numbers are?"
"No, but they're in the truck."
As we started back, the tone became a little more conversational. I commented on the weather, and he related how he and his friends had been surprised by the little storm last night, how the roads had been slick with snow coming off the mountain. "You fellows were hunting on the mountain?"
"Yes, sir."
He unlocked the Chevy and dug into the center console, where I caught a glimpse of a red box indicating Federal brand ammunition. After a moment, he produced four bright and shining bow-hunting permits. Bow-hunting permits. I pursed my lips and blew out. "You fellas are bow-hunters?"
"Yes, sir."
I checked the permits. They were all Mountain 24-166-25.
"Look, is there something we're being charged with? Should I be getting a lawyer or something?"
"I'm hoping that won't be necessary, Mr. Anderson. Do you or any of your party have any firearms?"
"No."
Maybe he was just nervous. "You sure?"
"Yes. Well..."
Moment of truth.
"Randy has a .38 in the glove box."
"Is it loaded?"
"It might be."
"Are you aware that a loaded, vehicularly concealed weapon constitutes a misdemeanor offense in this state?" "Vehicularly? Was that a word? Where did I get this stuff?" I smiled again to let him know I didn't think he was Al Capone. "So let's say you and I make a deal. I won't examine the legendary Randy's pistol to see if it's loaded, and you answer a few more of my questions." He figured it was a good deal. I pulled the section map out of my coat pocket, spread it out, and, with Mike's help, held it on their hood. He said they had asked at the Game and Fish about sections 23 and 26 because Anderson's father had hunted there years ago, claiming the deer on the Powder River draw were much larger than those on the mountain. Anderson's father was right. But I didn't share that with Mike. My ranch was in that section. They had driven out there Friday at noon and circled up along the Powder River, coming back past Arvada, Clearmont, and Crossroads. "Did you get off the main road at any point?"
"Three times. Once to watch some antelope just at the top of the hill after that little town at the main road,
Arvada.
Once where there was an old bridge headed south."
"Maybe something. An old King's Bridge structure?"
His face was blank.
"A trestle system of steel girders that goes over the road with an old car stuffed into the bank on the far side?"
"Yes, sir, now that you mention it."
"Did you see anyone or anything else out there?" He paused to think. I was going to have to talk to all of them. Was I ever going to get to sleep?
"No."
"You sure?"
"Yes, sir."
"Did anybody see you?"
"No, I mean, there were some cars and trucks that went by."
He was thinking hard, but wasn't coming up with anything. "But you didn't speak to anyone?"
"No."
"What about the third stop?"
His face brightened. I guess he figured the governor had called with a reprieve. "We had lunch at a little place about 20 miles out."
"The Red Pony?"
He pointed a finger at me, and I started figuring that Anderson sold something for a living. "That was it."
I asked him what they had, and he said cheeseburgers. I asked how they were, and he said they were okay. "Just okay?"
"Yes, sir. Why? Is that important?"
A gust of wind fluttered the map. "No, I just want to give the chief cook and bottle washer some flack. You ate at this place on the way back to town. About what time was that?"
"Right after noon, maybe 1.
I took out my pen and made some notes on the map.
"Your picture's on the wall, out there at the bar with all the medals, maps and stuff, isn't it?"
I continued to scribble away.
"You two were in the war together? You and the Indian guy?"
"Yep, the war to start all wars." I don't think he got it.
"I mean, the food wasn't that bad."
He started sounding apologetic. I couldn't wait to give Henry an earful.
"It took him a little while to get it out to us, but I think he had just opened. You sure get your money's worth. He cut the fries out of potatoes right there on the bar. And I got this cheeseburger that had about a half pound of jalapenos on it."
I stopped scribbling. Chapter 3. There was a clattering as someone tried to pull what sounded like pots and pans from one of the many boxes that lined the kitchen wall. My head slumped against my pillow. Almost 14 hours of sleep, and I still felt like shit. It looked like a nice day, though. From my perspective, near the floor, I had a clear view of brilliant blue skies without a cloud in sight. There was more noise from the kitchen and whistling. Unless I missed my guess, it was Prokofiev's Symphony No. 1, sometimes in D, and it was being butchered. I dragged myself to a sloped sitting position and stretched my back, allowing the little muscle just left of my spine and halfway down to decide how it was going to let me live today. The prognosis was fair. I looked through the opaque plastic coating that still clung to the glass door between the bedroom and kitchen, pushed to my feet, and stumbled. I turned the glass knob, stolen almost a decade ago from our rented house in town, and confronted the Cheyenne Nation, who was resplendent in his old Kansas City Chiefs jersey, complete with your name printed on the back. "Hey, people are trying to sleep in here. After 14 hours, you have constituted clinical death." He was popping open a can of biscuits on the particle board edge of the counter and lining an old pie pan with them. "Did you wash that?" He paused. "Should I have?" "Well, there's mouse shit on most of that stuff." His shoulders sagged as he pulled the biscuits out of the pan and inspected the underside of each one. "How do you live like this?" He turned to look at me. "Will you please go put some clothes on?" I retreated into the bedroom, retrieved my bathrobe from the nail in the stud wall, and ambled back to the kitchen. I took a seat on the stool by the counter and poured a cup of coffee into a Denver Broncos mug. I figured it was my job to do everything possible to irritate him this afternoon. I was feeling better. "What's for brunch?"
"You mean besides mouse shit?"
He had dropped about 2 pounds of pork sausage into a frying pan that I couldn't recall ever having seen before. I took a sip of the French roast. It seemed like all I did was drink the stuff. Katie sent me fancy whole bean coffee from Philadelphia in trendy little resealable bags, but I hadn't gotten around to getting a grinder. Game day. It was a tradition. Twice a year we found ourselves locked in the death struggle of the AFC Western Division, Broncos versus Chiefs, Pancake Day and Game Day on the same weekend. "Yes, I know. You're going to get your ass kicked today."
"Oh, please."
I tried the coffee again. It wasn't so bad. "Where did you find a grinder?" He ignored me and continued to look through the Folgers can that held my meager selection of utensils, so I asked, "Spatula?"
"Yes."
I looked at the scattered containers resting haphazardly against the wall, at the strata of Rainier beer crates that were stacked in every available space. It was daunting, but he had found a frying pan. "Box."
"Jesus."
The pork sausage began to sizzle. He approached the boxes and began going through them in a methodical fashion, top row first, left to right.
"Wald, we need to go over a few things."
This had an ominous tone to it.
"There was a time when this particular lifestyle had its place, the grieving widower valiantly sallying forth through a sea of depression and cardboard. This gave way to the eccentric lawman era, but now, Walt, my friend, you are just a slob."
I hugged my coffee cup a little closer and straightened my robe.
"I'm a lovable slob."
He had made it through the top row and was now working the collapsed fringe toward the back door.
"At the risk of sending you into a tailspin, Martha has been dead for 4 years.
3. He stopped and leaned against the door facing, the other hand at his side. The sausage popped, sending a small splatter to the plywood floor. I looked at the splatter mark. It was relatively contained, with a few scalloped edges due to the height of trajectory, ray-emitting tendrils reaching for the center of the room. If the object emitting the splatter is in motion, the drops will be oval and have little tails, which will project in the horizontal direction that the drop was moving. As the top of the teardrop lands last, splatters on a wall can tell you if the assailant is left or right-handed. I knew a lot about splatters. I wondered how Vic was doing. I looked at the unopened manila envelope sitting in my chair, a priority set of pictures illustrating the next-to-final resting place of Cody Pritchard. I had been so tired by the time I had gotten home that I had thrown them on the recliner, too exhausted to concentrate. Ruby's handwriting looked personal and out of place. Scene investigation photographs, 9:29, 2:07 a.m. 4. His eyes were level, and his voice carried a tired resignation to the battle joined. "Walt, it's time to get on with your life. I mean, college kids live better than this." I didn't know what to say. I had had a kid in college and then in law school, and she had lived better than this. "But I have a fourfold plan for your redemption." I sipped some more coffee and stared at the floor. "Does this involve getting me a woman?" He pulled the spatula out of the nearest box. I advised him to wash it, which he did after making a face, then set about breaking up the brick of meat in the pan. "Getting you a woman is the third part." "I like this plan, but I think we should move the third part up. We have to get you to the point where you are worthy of a woman." "Why do I get the feeling that I'm not going to like the other parts of this plan?" "Walt, your life is a mess. Your house is a mess. And you are a mess. It's about time we did some cleaning up." He looked around the cabin, I'm sure for dramatic effect. "Let us start with the easy stuff. This was a nice little house when you first got started, but that was 5 years ago." I thought it was 4. "You have got to get some gutters so the runoff stops cutting a moat around the house. You're going to have to use a bleach solution to cut the gray off the things and then put some UV protection on them. You need a porch, and a deck out back would not be such a horrible thing." My head hurt. "I don't have the time for all that, let alone the energy." He found the opener on the counter and began opening a number of small cans. "We are not talking time, energy, or money, which will be your next argument. We are talking inclination. Now, I know these two young men. Oh, no. I'm not going to have a bunch of thieving redskins roaming around my place while I'm not here." He choked, laughing, his arms spread wide to encompass the entirety of the room. "What would they steal?" He had a point. "These boys just started up their own contracting firm. They are hungry, cheap, and they're good. I can have them over here tomorrow morning at 8. I looked around the room at the stud walls, exposed wiring and dirt-encrusted plywood floors. I sighed. "Okay, what's part 2? "We get you in shape." I took another sip of coffee. It was getting cold. "Oh, I'm past that shit. I want you to think about part 3. He smiled. "I want you to think about part 3 while we're going through parts 1 and 2. He bumped me in the shoulder, and I spilled a little coffee. More splatters. He turned and dumped a small can of green chilies into the pan. "I don't suppose any of this might stem from conversations you may or may not have had with Katie, Ruby, or Vic." He was working the meat around, and the smell of the green peppers was intoxicating. "I talk with a lot of people about a lot of things. How come you didn't talk to me about Cody Pritchard eating his last meal at the Pony?" He placed the metal stem of the spatula on the edge of the frying pan so that the plastic handle wouldn't melt, and leaned against the counter. I listened to him breathe, and realized how much he had aged in the last 20 years, or the last 2 seconds. After a moment, he reached across the counter with a steady hand and poured me another cup. I didn't think it was that important. You ran out of the place Friday night and didn't say a word to anybody, and I knew I was going to see you this morning. I guess I thought I had more important things to talk to you about. He poured himself a cup and placed the pot back on the burner. He looked me in the eye just to clear the air.
Well, officer, it was the night of November 2nd at approximately 6:02 p.m. that the aforementioned one Pritchard Cody entered the establishment known as the Red Pony. Witnesses to this fact are Messrs. Charlie Smallhorse, Clell Phillips, and the attesting Henry Standing Bear. The condition of Mr. Pritchard at that time was one of profound intoxication, whereupon he was refused alcoholic beverage and served one Mexican cheeseburger deluxe, including fries and a Coke. 25 minutes later, there was a verbal altercation between Mr. Pritchard and Mr. Smallhorse, which resulted in Mr. Pritchard being escorted to the door of the establishment and asked to leave. The last I saw of Cody, he wheeled that piece of shit Palomino primer truck of his around in my parking lot, sprayed gravel, and headed east to a far better place than he had ever been before. So, do you want to book me, or you want to go take a shower? He sipped his coffee.
You seem a little defensive.
No shit. I just want to keep my proficiency and conduct reports up to snuff.
He smiled a tight little smile.
Anything else?
No. You pretty well covered it. I think I'll go take a shower. I stood up and walked past him toward the bathroom. I picked up the coffee since it was growing on me. I was hoping he'd say something, anything that would give me the excuse to turn around.
Do not get me wrong, Walt. I didn't like the kid, but then I do not know anybody who did. If you are looking for a suspect, just open the phone book.
He was watching the sausage as it burbled.
Are there any leads?
I sighed and leaned against the refrigerator. Toxicology at DCI said a high content of brewed barley malt, cereal grains, hops, and yeast,
known in the trade as Bush Light.
Ground beef, jalapenos, and American cheese.
Mexican cheeseburger, anything else?
Nothing from toxicology. Ballistics says no lands or grooves, and the deformity of impact with the sternum makes identification that much more difficult. His curiosity sharpened.
Smoothbore?
I shrugged. Who knows? But if it is, it narrows the search to 10 yards or less.
Which means it was somebody the little shit knew.
He smiled the tight smile again.
At least well enough to let them get close with a shotgun.
He pushed down on the frying pan handle, allowing the grease to puddle at the end of the skillet closest to him.
That is pretty close.
Yep.
No companions, no tracks.
Nope.
Any cover?
My turn to smile. That Powder River country, there's a good-looking woman behind every tree. He joined me for the rest. There just ain't any trees.
Back to square one. Wadding or contact dispersal?
Nope, no powder tattooing either.
Any hope of brass?
Ferg and that bunch didn't come up with anything. He grunted.
I will withhold comment on whether Ferg and his bunch could slap their ass with both hands.
He frowned at the frying pan, spooned the pooled grease into a measuring cup that he must have used to apportion tomato paste, and flipped the majority of the contents.
Meteorite?
I had to smile. The more people I talk to, the more I am convinced that this may have been an act of God.
Hate to see the Supreme Being take the fall for this one.
He sees even the smallest sparrow fall.
That would pretty much describe the decedent, but would this not be stretching the jurisdiction thing?
Maybe. The mood had lightened, and it was an opportunity that I couldn't pass up.
Hey.
He looked at me, and the expression his face carried was one of open concern for a friend who had all but accused him of impeding a murder investigation. My heart wasn't in the question, but I had to ask. "You know the scuttlebutt on the Reyes?"
"What, you worried about the Indian vote?"
He smiled to let me in on the joke, but it still hurt.
"What?"
"The little bird rape case."
"Melissa."
"Melissa." I was feeling lower and lower. "What's the general feeling on the Reyes about the job I did?" There was a brief look of irritation as he flipped his hair back and trapped what would have been a fine tail on a good cutting horse in a leather strip he had pulled from the back pocket of his jeans.
"General feeling,"
he pointed up the phrase as silly white man talk,
"is that you could have done better."
"And what is the basis of my failure?" He turned his head and looked into the distance at the log wall only 2 feet away.
2 years suspended sentence, 2 years parole.
"People don't think Vern Selby and a jury had something to do with that?"
"These people don't have any bond with that judge or jury, none of whom were Indian, and they do with you."
He paused.
"He should take that as a grave compliment."
He opened a ziplocked bag of pre-shredded cheese and offered me some. I took a pinch and stuffed it in my mouth. Pepper jack.
"Anyway, the goodwill of these people is not going to have much effect on your condition. There's only one person who can offer you absolution in this case, and he is a difficult individual with whom to deal. He forgives everyone but himself, and he never forgets."
We stood looking at each other, chewing.
"You should go take a shower. Part 3 said she would be here for kickoff at 2.
He pulled open the door of the oven and checked on his biscuits. The smell was marvelous. "Part 3?
"Vonnie Hayes expressed a desire to participate in the bonding ritual this afternoon. I thought it might lead to a more desirable ritual between the two of you later this evening."
I took a moment to reply. "I just saw her yesterday morning. She didn't say anything."
"Women seem to enjoy surprising you, perhaps because it's so easy."
I looked around the house at the piles of books and accumulated dirt on the floors, the walls, and the ceiling. "Oh, shit." He followed my eyes and shook his head.
"Yes, it's very bad. But we will tell her you are under construction. Red Road Contracting, the young man I told you about, will be here tomorrow morning."
He pulled the biscuits from the oven and placed them on one of the front burners.
"Go take a shower."
I started, but turned. "What's part 4?
"Spirituality. But that may have to come from somebody else."
I turned the water on in the shower and spent the time waiting for it to heat up by inspecting my bullet holes. I had 4. One in the left arm, one in the right leg, and 2 in the chest. I looked at the one in my left arm, since it was the closest. It was 357/100 of an inch with 2 clean marbled white dots on either side. The one on the inside had well-defined edges and was about the size of a dime. On the other side, it was blurred, had a tail like a tadpole that had drifted back to my elbow, and was about the size of a silver dollar. The water temperature was acceptable, so I stepped in and grabbed a bar of oatmeal soap that Katie had sent me. I liked it because it didn't smell. I kicked at the slow contraction of the vinyl curtains. It was a monkey-shit brown Olds Delta 88, with 2 hubcaps, an appealing blonde vinyl top. I could see they were kids and just flipped the lights on for a second so they would pull over. It took what seemed like a little too long for them to do it. The driver threw open the door and started back toward the car I was using at the time. I figured he was upset because I'd pulled him over for what seemed like nothing. I was wrong. He was upset because he and his friend had robbed a liquor store in Casper and had gotten away with $943 when I stopped them en route to Canada. I lathered up, rinsed off, and felt like I had new skin. I reached for the shampoo, and feeling how light the bottle was, made a mental note to get some more. I had enough unattended mental notes to fill up the Sears wish book. Near as we could figure, the bullet must have ricocheted off the window facing of the car and passed through my left arm. People always ask what it's like, and the only answer I can come up with is that it's like having a red-hot poker shoved into your flesh. It burns and it hurts like hell, but only after. I wondered mildly if Vonnie would think that bullet holes are sexy. Martha didn't. She hated them. A beautiful woman in my house. A woman who looked you over from head to toe, was confident and interested. I felt complicated and dreary. I wiped off the mirror to look into the eyes of Dorian Gray. What I saw did not inspire me with confidence. My hair, wet or dry, has a tendency to stand on end. I fought with it for a while and decided that it was a good thing I was able to wear a hat in my chosen profession. I have large, deep-set gray eyes, a gift from my mother, and a larger-than-normal chin, a gift from my father. The older I get, the more I think I look like a Muppet. Katie vehemently disagrees with this assessment, but she's fighting her own battle with this particular gene puddle.